You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wai Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whai akane, come up on the show today. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about charter schools, changes to the Education and Training Act, removing school boards' responsibilities to adhere to Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and the Regulatory Standards Bill passing into law. I also spoke to George Perry, a professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland, about the recent Tongariro wildfires that have devastated the region. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Greenpeace campaigner Jen Toop about the passing of the Regulatory Standards Bill into an act last week and what it means for corporate interests over the environment in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I also spoke to Professor in Public Health at the University of Auckland, Chris Bullen, about New Zealand dropping in the Global Tobacco Interference Index rankings and what that means for smoking policy and health in Aotearoa.
Hey, aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tukupatuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
A few weeks ago, Kelson Boys High School in West Auckland said they were at the front of an unsupported attempted takeover to turn the school into a charter school. As well as this, more recently, the New Zealand Campus of Innovation and Sport, a charter school set to be established next year, was signed with a trust that did not exist. Amendments have also been made to the Education and Training Act, removing a clause requiring school boards to give effect to Te Tiriti o Waitangi. The move has seen backlash from the National Iwi Chairs Forum and a growing number of schools who have launched a petition against the move. Finally, the controversial Regulatory Standards Bill has passed its third reading and is now set to be implemented into law. The bill previously received 156,000 public submissions, with 98.7% of those voicing their opposition to the bill. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to him about these topics. I started off by asking Court about Kelston Boys High School and the New Zealand Campus of Innovation and Sport, and how concerning these developments are for the ACT Party.
Well, the charter schools legislation and policy is intended to help kids have better choices in education. And when we look at Kelston, for example, the reason that Kelston Boys has been identified as a suitable place for a charter school is because that school's faced long-term challenges. Now, parents and students have voted with their feet. The roll was around 1,100 students in 2010. It fell to the mid-600s by 2022. It has lifted slightly since then. But even with that increase, the school relies more on out-of-zone enrolments than in-zone families, which just indicates that there's a sustained lack of confidence amongst local parents and kids who want to know that they can go to a good school and that when they go on to the next thing, to higher education or training or work, that they won't be judged by having attended a school that doesn't meet community expectations. So, look, the proposal for a charter at Kelston is entirely legitimate, and that isn't exactly what the legislation is supposed to do. You also mentioned the trust error, the naming issue around New Zealand Performance Academy. That was simply an administrative error. I understand that under a previous trust name, the same people, the same organisation, the same financials, simply having changed their trust name, they hadn't updated their application documents to New Zealand Performance Academy. Aotearoa. I understand that that's been rectified.
But how did this fall through the slips? And I also want to touch on Kelston. Most of the school board are in favour of it staying as a state school. So are you essentially saying that you would like the school to be converted to a charter school?
Well, that's not up to me. That's what the Independent Charter School Authorisation Board is for. They will determine whether the proposal has the capability and evidence required to improve outcomes. And that's where boards like Kelston, despite being well-meaning and people with the best intentions, don't necessarily have the capability and the competence to improve outcomes. Now, when I was living in that part of Auckland, we had a great principal at Kelston called Graham Henry, who went on to become the All Blacks coach. He inspired students. That was a huge magnet for people in the community to want to attend that, send their sons to that school, because it was a high-performing school with a high-performing principal. Clearly something's gone terribly wrong in the intervening years, that the school role has essentially halved. And so, whatever the school board might think about the current situation and how things are turning around, actually, this is where the opportunity to evaluate what they think they can achieve versus what a proposed charter can achieve. This is the right place and forum to do it, through the Independent Charter School Authorisation Board process.
Charter schools as a concept are already quite polarising. Could these recent cases lower New Zealanders' confidence in these schools?
Well, they're not polarising amongst parents and students who have attended charter schools and got great results out of them. I know young people who have attended Vanguard Military School who would otherwise have not remained in education and training, and those young people have then gone on to start careers in construction and other industries. Now, it might be polarising for those who are absolutely wedded to the concept that only governments can educate children and only in a one-size-fits-all model, but actually that's not what parents and students are asking for. They're asking for school choice, and they're asking for schools that are local and that can deliver high-quality education without them having to send their children out of zone or to independent schools or to Catholic schools, for example, because that's the choice that people in Kelston have been making for over a decade. And, I actually feel for them and for the next generation of young people, currently going through primary school and then intermediate, who want to know, Mum, Dad, am I going to be able to go to school in my local neighbourhood, or am I going to have to go somewhere else because, I want to achieve an education and I can't be confident? So, look, that's what charter schools are for. They're delivering choice. Parents and students are voting with their feet. They want to go, and that's why we have such a significant number of applications for charter schools across the country.
I just want to repeat the latter part of that question again. Could these recent cases with Kelston Boys High School and the New Zealand Campus of Innovation and Sport lower New Zealanders' confidence in these schools with what we've been seeing in the space?
I don't think so at all. And like I said, parents and young people are voting with their feet. They're choosing charters. And that's why more and more charters are being proposed. And that's why more and more charters will be stood up over the next year or so. I think the results speak for themselves.
You mentioned that more charter schools would be set up, and you are correct. The government has allocated $153 million for 15 new charter schools and the conversion of 35 state schools into charter schools for the rest of this year in 2026. What is the party doing in this space to mitigate the concerns we have seen with Kelston Boys and the New Zealand Campus of Innovation and Sport heading forward?
Well, like I said, around the New Zealand Performance Academy of Aotearoa contract, that was a naming error, so that's been rectified. And I understand that David Seymour, who's the minister responsible for charter schools, is confident that, that's been sorted out. And around Kelston, I'll reiterate for the third time, those who are demonstrating and showing confidence in the charter schools approach are parents and students who are seeking choice, seeking something different, whether it's a Pacific Girls Academy, whether it's a sports academy built around the Phoenix football team in Wellington, or whether it's a school run by Te Ao Māori organisations delivering their education and training for construction and practical skills in Hawke's Bay. You know, that's the kind of choice that people have been crying out for in education for a generation. David Seymour stood up charter schools in 2014 to 17 when he was Associate Minister of Education. Previous government, through their own ideological dislike of them, patched them over and brought them back into the Ministry of Education framework. But look, this is a new dawn, and Kiwis are voting with their feet, students and parents, to come to charter schools. So I think this approach has got a really bright future.
Speaking more to education and sort of moving on to the next topic, we have also seen an amendment to the Education and Training Act, removing a clause requiring school boards to give effect to Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Why have we seen these changes to the Education and Training Act?
Well, because school boards were effectively being asked to undertake their own interpretation of treaty principles and translate them into governance, policy and classroom practice. It was just creating confusion, it was diverting them time away from teaching and learning. I mean, do you really want school boards to be navel-gazing about what it means to give effect to the treaty, or would you want them focusing on making sure that students have all the resources that they need, that the school is maintained and its assets are looked after properly, which is another role of school boards, and that, the teachers at the school are lifting literacy, numeracy, rates and kids are coming to school, the attendance is being improved. So all of those things are important enough for school boards to do without having to wonder about how do we give effect to the treaty, which is actually a crown obligation to iwi and hapu under the 1840 Treaty of Waitangi. So the government's just said, look, focus on your core business and leave it up to the crown to make sure that obligations to iwi and hapu are fulfilled.
The National Iwi Chairs Forum's Pō Tangata Chair Rahui Papa says iwi leaders were deeply disappointed by these last-minute amendments, adding that these amendments were introduced after public consultation had closed. Why were these amendments so last-minute, as he says?
Well, I would disagree with that characterisation of them being last-minute. The policy that was developed and introduced at the Committee of the Whole House stage, MPs from both sides of the House had an opportunity to debate this policy and to ask the Minister and the Chair questions about it. It fulfils one of the ambitions of this government, which is to lift up the role of iwi, Māori, hapu in the system from, having everybody having to consider how to give effect to the treaty and actually restore that obligation on the crown. And so, this is all going in the right direction. No one should be surprised, least of all the what I would consider the highly politicised iwi chairs forum.
Vocational Education Minister Penny Simmons says the government is focused on boosting educational achievement and closing the equity gap. However, the previous requirements under the treaty had ensured school boards reflect local tikanga Māori, Wātauranga Māori and Te Ao Māori in their planning and policies, among other things. Would this not have the opposite effect in closing the equity gap, especially for Māori students?
Yeah, these are just two completely divergent concepts, aren't they? The equity gap is where you have children and young people arriving at school who don't have any literacy skills whatsoever. They may be living in rural and remote communities where they don't have access to facilities and opportunities, so that they are prepared to get to school. And during their schooling, they're not necessarily supported at home or by their communities to achieve to their potential. So there's a number of reasons for that, and it's very important that educators and the education system focus on that. But can you really imagine that when the chief sat down with Governor Hobson in 1840, they were like, when our kids go to school, we want to make sure that, that the Treaty of Waitangi is given effect to in the classroom. That doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't make any sense to parents. While there might be some political activists who think it's the right thing to do, kids just need to go to school and learn, and parents need to be confident that they're picking up core skills, literacy, numeracy, and of course the other things this government is introducing, updating the history curriculum and making that science focuses on things like, atoms and DNA rather than spiritual matters and other things.
Lastly, we have seen the Regulatory Standards Bill pass its third and final reading. We touched on this last week and we don't have a lot more time this morning, so I just have one question here. Now that this bill has passed into law, what's next?
What it means is that for decades we've had laws that hide compliance costs and allow poor quality regulation just to pile up. Now we're going to have scrutiny so that every law that gets proposed is subject to some very rigorous test. Will this law actually work to solve the problem that it's proposed to do? Will the costs of imposing the law be less than the benefits the law is supposed to deliver? And thirdly, you know, when passing this law or regulation, does it have a severe impact on private property? And if so, why should those private property owners, whether they be businesses or landowners, face that cost when the benefits are public? Now, the laws can still be passed, but all of those questions and answers will be transparent, and so the voters of New Zealand and those who are subject to these laws will have an opportunity to actually chip in at submission stage, you know, for example, at select committee stage, and confirm whether they think that it's actually fair to pass such laws which propose impositions on people, even though the law might not actually work and, you know, might cost more than the benefits it creates. I mean, look, anyone involved in business, anyone involved in any kind of delivery, whether it's community organisation, voluntary organisation, would know you don't start doing stuff unless you know it's going to work and it's actually going to deliver better benefits than the budget you've got to deliver it. So, you know, that's what we've done for Kiwis, and ACT is really, really proud of it.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on some developments in the charter school space, the amendment to the Education and Training Act removing a clause requiring school boards give effect to Te Tiriti Tō Waitangi, and the Regulatory Standards Bill passing its third reading.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, the government passed the Regulatory Standards Bill into the Regulatory Standards Act. Long controversial, failing to pass in its first three readings and subject to enormous opposition and submissions during the process, the law is the child of David Seymour's ACT Party. But now that this law has passed, these serious concerns are of urgency. Particularly, there are loud concerns and criticisms of the primacy granted to corporate interests in the face of Te Tiriti Tō Waitangi and the environment. I spoke to Greenpeace campaigner Jen Toop about the Act, what it means for the environment, and what should be done in the face of this policy threat. To get us started, what does the Regulatory Standards Bill actually lay out?
Yes, so the Regulatory Standards Bill, or it's an Act now, is a really an unprecedented threat to New Zealand's environment, to future government's ability to respond to environmental challenges, to the Crown's ability to uphold Te Tiriti Tō Waitangi, and also to continue to have and build a stronger, fairer democracy. And the reason it is all of those things is basically three main issues with it. So the first is that what the bill does is sets out a bunch of principles, which are the ACT Party's principles, which all future lawmakers will have to consider when they are making regulations. And those principles explicitly exclude the Treaty of Waitangi, our founding document. They explicitly exclude environmental protection and community and public and worker well-being. And instead of including those, they actually include property rights and individual freedoms, and they prioritise them above all else. So when any future lawmaker is making a regulation in New Zealand, they're going to have to consider these principles first. The second main issue with it is that for the first time in the history of Aotearoa, this new law has created the financial compensation expectation. So what that means is that if a future government wants to make a regulation to protect the environment, to ensure we have clean drinking water, to deal with the climate change, then they will be expected to compensate any corporation that has had their property rights impacted. So when I say property there too, I'm not just meaning land. They haven't said that. They haven't defined property in the bill. It could mean all sorts of things, including potential future lost profits. So it could mean things like oil rigs or milking sheds or any infrastructure owned by a company. If the government makes a law that impacts that, then the taxpayer will be expected to pay corporations for the regulations that are designed to protect our environment and to protect our communities. And a third way that this bill really creates this massive threat to our environment and our democracy is that for all future governments wanting to make new regulations to protect us and to protect the environment, they're basically going to have to run this really bureaucratic gauntlet and basically justify why they might make some regulations that prioritise community and environmental well-being above corporate property rights rather than the other way around. No future politician should have to justify why they are doing their job governing for the well-being of our people and our environment instead of governing on behalf of corporations. But that's what this law creates, and it also creates what they're calling a regulatory standards board, which is an unelected board appointed by the author of this bill, David Seymour, who has been given really unfettered and extraordinary powers through the law to really dictate what goes on with lawmaking in New Zealand. But this this regulatory standards board is essentially a corporate complaints board. So any corporation that doesn't like a law in New Zealand, and not just one that's in draft that the government's considering putting through, but all of our current laws. So that includes things like any environmental protections we currently have that protect our drinking water. It would have included, until the government repealed it, the ban on oil and gas drilling. So corporations can say, we don't like this law, we think it impacts on our property rights, regardless of the benefits it has to the environment, to worker safety, to community well-being, we want this board to review it. And then the board, who will be made up with, who the minister has already said is going to be stacked with economists. And economists are important, but they don't represent all of the important things that we value in New Zealand. And this board is going to do the review and probably say it doesn't align with David Seymour's principles that as are laid out in this law. And then the minister who is in charge of that law is going to have to stand up in Parliament and justify again why they're doing their job governing for the well-being of our people and our country and not following David Seymour's rigid set of quite far-right neoliberal principles about how he thinks our society here in New Zealand should operate.
And looking at this Act and the primacy that it gives to corporations, what do Greenpeace expect to see from the government, particularly in this term and maybe going forward, in terms of utilising these changes to impact the environment in negative ways?
Well, I think we are really concerned about how this law is going to be used by corporations and industries that have really negative impacts on the environment. I think we will see some companies make complaints to the Corporate Complaints Board or the Regulatory Standards Board and about laws and regulations that are designed to protect the environment. And I'm not just that, you know, this is protecting all sorts of things to do with the environment. So it's to do with protecting native wildlife and ensuring they don't go extinct, but also making sure that the drinking water that comes out of our taps is clean and is not going to make us sick, that the air that we breathe is clean, and that we're taking steps to ensuring we really address climate change, which is obviously has huge impacts on our communities, and we're already seeing that with massive flooding and wildfires and all these extreme weather events that are being made worse and really impacting as well on food production. So all these things that have real tangible effects on the lives of every single New Zealander, I think we're going to see corporations complain about laws that are designed to deal with those issues that we're facing, and using the argument that their interests are not being prioritised, that they haven't been compensated for these laws that affect them, and we're gonna see the government being given, I guess, more ammunition to further undermine the remaining environmental protections that we have in New Zealand, because it's hard to overstate it. They have essentially enacted a war on nature. What we've already seen, which is a very positive sign, is that in response to the huge public opposition, I mean, we're talking 159,000 submissions on this bill, and 98% of them were opposed. We're talking almost every single ministry and agency asked to give advice on it, raising serious concerns, not just the Ministry for the Environment, but the Ministry for Justice, the Ministry for Health, not just environmental groups either. You know, we've seen Māori academics and iwi and hapu incredibly opposed to this law because it really undermines Te Tiriti o Waitangi, explicitly excludes it from the lawmaking process. I mean, it also does what the Treaty Principles Bill tried to do, which is try and make sure that formal equality instead of equity is really enshrined. So that means that laws that are designed to address the inequities that have been, you know, generated through the colonial history of Aotearoa, which has really negatively impacted Māori, they would be considered inconsistent with the Regulatory Standards Act.
And looking kind of past that repealing, or looking past other parties' opposition, what do Greenpeace want to see in terms of policy or frameworks to make sure that this can't happen again?
Well, I mean, it shouldn't have happened in the first place when you think about the fact that the ACT Party has been trying to pass this bill for 20 years, and for the first three times it tried it, it was rejected through proper parliamentary and democratic processes. It was rejected. But moving forward, in terms of what kind of policies does the next incoming government need to bring in, or what do we need to see this government start to do, is to recognise how important it is to protect the environment, to protect nature, not just because nature in itself is inherently valuable, which it is, and I think many New Zealanders believe that. You know, we have a lot of care and love for our native wildlife, for our native birds, because we see that they are inherently valuable. But we also need to recognise that we are wholly dependent on the environment. So what we need to see is laws and regulations that prioritise the well-being of our people, the well-being of our environment, instead of prioritising the property rights of corporations, many of whom are multinational corporations. We need to see a government upholding the Treaty of Waitangi, not constantly attacking it, and we need to see a government really prioritise long-term health and well-being of our country, and that means not running roughshod over environmental protections, rebuilding so much of the environmental protections and laws that we need rebuilt after 2 years of this government. That's what we really want to see going forward, and I don't think it's too much to ask.
That was Greenpeace campaigner Jen Toop on the Regulatory Standards Bill, now Act, and what it means for corporate interests over the environment.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Why'd you call on the day you departed? Did I convince you? Or have I always been too far behind? I swear I'm here now. So you go and I stay. I don't own your time or your place. Shall we call it time? Tasteful and talented, you were a scar of all that had happened, Jade. I thought I had more to give. Did it have to be so hard? You were everything and nothing, nothing.
That was Calling Time by Elliot Dawson. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
On the 8th of November, a wildfire tore through 3,000 hectares of Tongariro National Park before being extinguished 4 days later. The fire resulted in multiple walks in the region being closed, including the Tongariro Alpine Crossing. However, as of today, many of these tracks have reopened. However, the full extent of the fire on the region's ecosystem is yet to be fully investigated. On Friday, I spoke to George Perry, a professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland, about this wildfire and how detrimental this fire will be on the region's ecosystem from what we are currently seeing. Do we know what caused this fire?
I don't think we do at the moment, but we know that more than 99% of fires in New Zealand are caused by human activity in one form or another. We naturally hear lightning's pretty rare in Aotearoa, so I would bet on it being human activity, whether deliberate or otherwise.
What did fire activity in the country look like before human intervention? How did fires usually start?
It's a very good question. So prior to the arrival of people in New Zealand around 800 years ago, we believe that fire was very infrequent and limited probably to the east coast of both islands and the montane basins of Otago. The absence of fire probably wasn't because of a lack of flammable vegetation, but simply there wasn't an ignition source. So naturally New Zealand has a very low lightning strike rate. So with the arrival of people in two waves, first Māori and then Europeans, there were huge changes in fire activity. We went from 85% forest cover down to about 20%, which we have now, and we're continuing to see those changes under climate change into the future.
Have we seen a fire of this capacity in the region beforehand?
This would be one of the largest fires, if not the largest fires in recent memory. The second half of the 20th century saw reduced fire activity as a result of various legislative changes. And the average fire size over that period was about 4,000 hectares. And so 3,000 hectares is large relative to that. In the colonial era, there were extremely large fires in forests through the country. And during the period of Māori settlement before Europeans, there would have been large fires as well, but reconstructing their exact size is challenging.
Could you touch on those legislative changes you just mentioned a little bit more?
I think there was just a series of legislative changes enacted through the 40s and 50s about the use of fire, formalisation of fire protection services, that sort of thing. There was a very large fire in Taupō in the mid-1940s in pine plantations, and I think that triggered just a change in how we think about fire and manage it.
How big of an impact has this fire had on the region's biodiversity that we know so far?
Very early to say. I mean, I think the fire is only just being classed as not active. It probably still has hot spots going on, and fires can smoulder for months. In a general sense, the challenge is that because New Zealand doesn't have a history of fire, not many of our plants and animals are well adapted to fire. And so in places like Australia or California, where there is more frequent fire, plants can resprout after fire, or they have underground storage organs, and that enables them to bounce back reasonably quickly within reason. Those traits are absent from our flora, and so it can be a very slow recovery. And there's a couple of risks. The first is that young vegetation, so things like manuka, kānuka, are very flammable. And so there is a risk of these systems falling into what we call fire traps, where there's fire and then more fire and more fire. And that's amplified by the presence of weeds, so things like gorse or pine trees, that are reasonably well adapted to fire and thrive in these post-fire environments. So recovery is slow. Every time there's a fire, that will make it slower. But certainly it's not impossible for the landscape to restore.
We'll touch on some of those weeds in a second, but first, and this kind of lends into what you just said, is this region susceptible to fires, or has this blaze been sort of out of left field?
That's a good question. I mean, I think if you asked a fire ecologist that, they would probably say to you, under the right conditions, anything will burn. And so there is no such thing as a landscape or an ecosystem that's immune to fire. It's a large open area, the vegetation there. There's a lot of manuka scrub, which is inherently flammable. What I think is a little surprising, and I think some of the locals have reflected this, is that it was wet over the winter, and there's only about 10 days or so of dry weather, and that seems to have been sufficient for this large fire to occur.
So only that short amount of time with dry weather could have impacted the extent of this fire. Is that essentially what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I guess usually we would associate large fire events with protracted drought periods, high winds occurring late in the summer. We've had a wet winter across most of New Zealand. We're in spring, summer. And so I wouldn't have expected the fuel to be super dry. But as I said, under the right conditions, anything will burn.
Could weeds such as the heather and broom, I guess, dominate the region more because of these fires, maybe even dominating the native flora we're seeing in the region?
Yes, there's already a problem with heather in the Central Plateau and in Tongariro. But experience in other fires across the country suggests that there is a risk of the ecosystem becoming dominated by these woody weeds. So gorse, which is probably the most flammable plant we have in the country, broom, heather, and a whole range of other probably less known things like hakea from Australia. All of those have traits that enable them to flourish after fire. And so the question really is not just what happens after this fire, but the next fire and the next fire. How can we avoid falling into these fire traps?
And touching more on that, does the country's current fire preparedness match the growing risks of similar climate-related disasters?
It's a good question, political question at the moment. I think that we're slowly realising that as climate changes and as land use changes, that we are facing a fierier future. I mean, in the last decade, there's been large fire events in the Port Hills, Tekapo, Pigeon Valley near Nelson, in this event at Tongariro. Perhaps in the past we were like, oh, that happens in Australia or California, but recent climate projections suggest that we will, over the coming decades, experience fire weather comparable to that in the 2019-20 fires in Australia. So I think we're slowly realising that the world is getting fierier. In New Zealand, Aotearoa is not immune, and hopefully slowly becoming more responsive to that. I think, you know, traditionally we focus perhaps on earthquakes and tsunami and volcanoes, being defensive around those, and we're beginning to have to acknowledge that for fire as well.
And heading forward, what fire preparedness would you like to see, or at least to minimise the effects of fires of this scale like we've seen in Tongariro or even anywhere else in the country? You mentioned the Port Hills and Te Akapo.
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, 99% of fires roughly in New Zealand are the result of human action, deliberate or otherwise. And so the easiest fire is the one that doesn't start. That's the easiest fire to manage. So I guess being sensible about the use of fire, following fire bans, tamaya tamaya, all of that sort of stuff's really important. If we think through the sort of classic fire triangle, you know, that's the ignition side. We also have the fuel side of things. We know that different fuels, different vegetation are more or less flammable. Fens and some colleagues and I at Lincoln have been developing a database of appropriate plants for gardens that are less flammable native plants. And so thinking about how we make the landscape defensible is important. And there are probably larger planning issues. A lot of fires globally and in Aotearoa occur at the sort of interface of the urban and the wildland areas. And so thinking about how we plan the growth of cities in places like the Port Hills is really important.
Could you imagine we could see similar fires of this scale, especially heading into summer maybe? Or is it too early to say?
It's too early to say this summer whether we'll have that. But I would expect that we will see more of this sort of event into the future. I mean, that's what all the climate projections suggest, that we will have. So the climate projections don't say we will have more fires directly, but they strongly point to an increasing prevalence of extreme fire weather. So in the eastern South Island and eastern North Island, 40 plus days per year of extreme fire risk. Those are already some of the driest parts of the country. So I think we can expect to see more fires of this size in the future. The one thing I would add is that probably this isn't a thing we can manage out of the system. We are going to have to live with fire, and there's lots of ways to do that. And I think, you know, we're increasingly going to be looking towards different knowledge systems to integrate to this. So it's a matter of living with fire rather than fighting it and putting it out. So it's really a question of social and ecological resilience as much as anything.
That was the University of Auckland's George Perry on the recent wildfire at Tongariro National Park and what impact the fire will have on the region's ecosystem.
I know you must have another question, so I'll shut up.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Thank you.
That was Computer Games by MySex and Summer Long by Amamelia.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Last week saw the release of the Global Tobacco Industry Interference Index. In it, Aotearoa ranked 53rd in the world, a whopping 52 places down from 2 years ago. This ranking 2 years ago was reflective of our robust anti-smoking laws. Since the current coalition government has repealed them, however, that reputation has come seriously into question. These rankings now serve as a warning about the role that the tobacco industry plays in health policy and New Zealand's failure to manage smoking and tobacco lobbying. I spoke to Professor of Public Health at the University of Auckland, Chris Bullen, about the ranking, tobacco influence in the government, and what it says about smoking in New Zealand as a whole. To get us started, what is this ranking?
Yeah, so the ranking is comes from a report that's produced annually by an organisation called the Southeast Asian Tobacco Control Alliance. And so that's a group of organisations in Southeast Asia who look at countries around the world and their compliance with a particular part of the world's first health treaty. It's called the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which really asks, it's around 20 years old now, and it's asked governments to sign up to take steps to control the scourge of tobacco. And that means things like increasing the price of tobacco, putting warning labels on, banning media advertising, and providing support for people to quit smoking. So many, many countries around the world are at various stages in complying with all those guidance measures, the articles. And the one that we're interested here is on about the requirement to try and put in place measures to stop interference by the tobacco industry on the development of policies which would help to reduce smoking in a population. And that's called Article 5.3 in the Framework Convention. So it's quite a bit of technical stuff. So the annual survey assesses countries' progress and adherence to this guidance. And New Zealand was kind of near the top of the class a few years ago. And that seems to have happened in the last 2 years. We've fallen from grace dramatically down to, 53rd. Now, we're not at the bottom of the table. There are many countries that are worse off, worse performing than us. But I think it's the rapid decline that shocked everybody. And it's a bit of a wake-up call, I believe, for our government.
When considering particularly public health perspectives on this kind of ranking, how might these rankings sort of reflect New Zealanders' exposure to the harms of tobacco?
Yeah, so the good news is that smoking has declined a lot over the last 10 or 20 years. New Zealand's been very good, regardless of which political party's been in power. New Zealand's steadily tightened the screws on tobacco smoking, and more and more people have quit smoking, and most young people don't smoke now. I mean, the majority of teenagers, 99% of them don't smoke overall. But there are still persisting inequities between population groups like Māori, Pacific, and non-Māori, non-Pacific. Smoking rates are quite different, with smoking being still more common. Even though the rates are declining in Māori and Pacific, it's still much more common than in non-Māori, non-Pacific people. And across different socioeconomic groups, smoking is more common in people who are less well off, and also people with mental health and drug abuse, drug misuse conditions. It's more common. So there's still work to be done, even if we're making progress with smoking. And tightening those screws means pushing back against what the tobacco industry wants, which is to sell more cigarettes, and right, its product. That's what it's there for. But the government's got a responsibility to prevent disease and protect the well-being of the people of New Zealand, and that means trying to make it harder and harder for those products to be available to be used in New Zealand. And we seem to be making a good job of it, but we've failed in shutting the door on the influence of the tobacco industry, which wants to slow that decline down and to introduce other products which could hook people and possibly get them smoking again. So that is the real concern, is that we've kind of let our guard down, and now we've got plain evidence that the tobacco industry has been sort of whispering in the ears of officials and potentially in ministers, and that's not a good thing for New Zealand generally.
On that, what sort of interference and influence are we seeing in terms of our own government and our own policies from the tobacco industry?
Yeah, well, we had world-leading tobacco control legislation that was supported by really good scientific evidence from research here in New Zealand and overseas, that measures of reducing the nicotine in cigarettes, reducing the number of cigarette outlets, and making it illegal to sell tobacco to anybody born after the 1st of January 2019. All those three measures, they were repealed when the coalition government took power. And that, so that's number one. So we were sort of heading in a really powerful direction, and suddenly the new government came in and they completely, you know, flipped that on its head. That's not to say they didn't claim that they were still committed to New Zealand becoming smoke-free by the end of 2025, but the measures they've kind of got left to them, having pulled the plug on those powerful ones, are relatively, you know, weak. So that was number one. Number two was the way they responded to criticisms of the repeal were really parroted from the kind of things you find in tobacco industry documents. The arguments that there would be a crime wave, there would be a huge increase in the amount of black market tobacco on sale, and we don't believe that's happened. There's no evidence. I've been involved directly in monitoring that, and we haven't seen that happen. And then the Minister of Health responsible for tobacco control, Associate Minister Cassie Costello, she said that she'd given the Ministry of Health some policy advice from a document, but it was one which she wasn't prepared to reveal. And it, when it was, she actually denied it existed initially. And she said she didn't know who wrote it. And then only after the chief ombudsman stepped in did the document get revealed. And that was full of arguments that contradicted our research from New Zealand. And it was really just a reflection of tobacco industry arguments that are used by lobbyists. And then there are also, it wasn't enough, under her leadership, the first ever excise tax on tobacco happened, and that was for the tobacco used in heated tobacco products like IQOS. And that was really a sort of a direct favour to the biggest tobacco company in the world, Philip Morris International, which operates that product, sells that product. And then there's lots of connections between people in government and people in the tobacco industry. It's a bit of a revolving door and lack of transparency about their interests. And, you know, that's a bigger part of the problem, that whole lack of transparency of government is a wider issue, even beyond tobacco. So I think there's, you know, a mounting body of concern and evidence that the government's behaved in a way which is more favourable to the tobacco industry and its interests rather than the interests of New Zealanders.
With this influence and interference in mind with ministers like Cassie Costello or even Chris Bishop, how can we kind of expect to see this interference play out for tobacco policy in the future?
Yeah. Well, I think we're seeing it at the moment. For example, the sole kind of focus of the current smoke-free strategy is on supporting people who smoke to quit smoking. And that in itself is a good thing. But there is no, around that, there is really nothing else that's particularly new that's driving to boost the motivation of people to line up and quit smoking, right? And so by making smoking less attractive, less addictive, less available, those are the things that we need to really work on to reduce the smoking inequities as quickly as possible and saving, you know, up to 5,000 lives a year while we dilly-dally around doing good things but in sort of very individual-focused. I just don't think it's going to be enough to get us to the kind of both targets for smoking, amounts of smoking, but also the longer-term benefits for health for the next few generations in New Zealand. So I think they're kind of playing to the hand of soft peddling rather than taking the strong action that's needed to put a real nail in the coffin of smoking in New Zealand.
And just finally, in terms of those goals that you've just mentioned, what do you want to see from this government and governments going forward in terms of kind of regaining our place in these rankings and implementing those strong anti-smoking measures?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the measures that were repealed need to be looked at again because time has passed. Smoking has declined, but it hasn't declined equitably. So I think we need to look at particularly the denicotinized tobacco strategy, because that was the one that was always going to work fast and be a pro-equity one. So I think that needs to be looked at again for you know, potentially governments in waiting or the current government if they fail to meet the goal, which was always for everybody, not just for overall 5% by the year for 2025. But broader than even smoking is just the whole issue of, you know, increasing transparency around reporting where money comes from, where people have been working, who are the lobbyists, how can we shut down the influence of commercial companies like tobacco industry on influencing government policy decisions, because they were always in their own interests and usually they are in opposition to the goals of public health.
That was Professor of Public Health at the University of Auckland, Chris Bullen, on the Global Tobacco Industry Interference Index and what New Zealand's drop in the rankings means for how we are dealing with tobacco.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Koira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Greenpeace's Jen Toop, and the University of Auckland's George Perry and Chris Bullen. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.